Welcome to this talk from the Canando Zen Meditation Center. Located in Mountain View, California, Canando's meditation practice is open to the public. For more information or to get in touch with us, you can visit our website at canando.org. That's K-A-N-N-O-N-D-O.org.
Okay, so good evening. Again, good evening, everybody. So something I wanted to share with you this evening are some reflections around practicing with clutter, and practicing when there is an overage of something in our lives, too much of something. And I've started my reflections around this, actually, when I was looking at a text recently by Master Keizan. And Master Keizan Jokin, is often referred to as the great patriarch of Soto Zen. He was born just after Master Dogen died, so around the mid 13th century in Japan. And so he's considered the third ancestor after Master Dogen. He was ordained by Kounijo, who was Master Dogen's successor. And then he received Dharma transmission from Tetsu Gikai, who followed on from Koun, from Master Eijo. So he was the third generation. And whereas Dogen is credited with bringing this particular line of Soto Zen from his teacher in China over to Japan and establishing the practice in Japan, Keizan's legacy is connected with the spread of this teaching and the popularization of this teaching. And another thing about Keizan was that he famously advanced the practice of women. He was greatly influenced by his grandmother and his mother, both of whom were Zen practitioners. His grandmother mostly raised him for the first 8 years of his life, supposedly, and she was a big supporter of Dogen after he came back from China. And Master Keizan's mother was actually a nun and a Dharma teacher in her own right. She founded two monasteries, and she became the abbess of one of the monasteries that she founded. And his mother was an adherent, or she very much venerated canon, who was embodied as a female goddess. She's the bodhisattva of compassion. And this influenced Keizan, who followed his mother's footsteps in his veneration of canon. The first Dharma transmission that Keizan gave was to a woman, to a nun. And so he was very much a supporter of women in the practice, which is something that has made him a very interesting figure to me, particularly as a female practitioner. He died at the age of 57. And in terms of his written legacy, there are two major texts that we have today to read by Master Keizan. One of them is more well known. It's called the Den Koroku, the record of the transmission of light. And in case you've never come across this book, it's, I think we have, I'm pretty sure we have a copy of it in Canando Library. It's basically a series of enlightenment stories of all of the Zen ancestors in the lineage that we consider from Buddha onwards. And so it's a series of these little biographies of all of the ancestors, and particularly centering around their enlightenment stories, and the idea that this light of awakening was transmitted from teacher to student across the generations. So that's the Den Koroku. And then there's another text that I've been reading more recently that I would very much recommend to anybody who hasn't maybe come across it yet, called the Zazen Yojinki. Now, it's a much shorter text than the Den Koroku, which kind of really makes a whole book. The Zazen Yojinki is a short text that's basically a kind of an encapsulation of Soto Zen practice, sort of like an introductory teaching. I think for those of you who are familiar with Dogen's Fukan Zazengi, there are some similarities and some echoes, even though the Fukan Zazengi is a little leaner, a little shorter as a text. They have a lot in common, and they clearly sort of, the Zazen Yojinki is clearly a sort of a follow-on from the Fukan Zazengi, from my point of view. So it translates as points to keep in mind while practicing Zazen. So one of the reasons I really have enjoyed reading this text is that it's quite straightforward, it's quite simple. And in general, I like to read introductory texts about Zen. I like to be told again and again the basics of this practice. I often feel like I really can't be told this enough. And particularly the ways in which various people or teachers or practitioners just choose to describe the practice for the first time to somebody. You know, what are the aspects of the practice that we choose to hold up? So a favorite activity of mine is attending an introduction to Zen. It's just something that I've done a lot of times over the course of my practice. And so thinking about Master Keizan, a kind of coincidence that occurred to me was a very special introduction to Zen that I received at Master Keizan's temple when I was traveling in Japan. So one of the things that Master Keizan did was, he was the founder of the Sojiji temple in Japan. And those familiar with the way that the Soto Zen headquarters are set up there might know that there are two joint temples in Japan that form the headquarters of the Soto Shu. One of them is Eheiji, which is the temple that Master Dogen set up. And the other one is Sojiji, which is the temple that Master Keizan founded. And Sojiji is currently located in Yokohama, which is just outside of Tokyo. But the original site of its founding is actually in a different part of the country, in a place called the Noto Peninsula. And that temple was originally like destroyed in a fire in the late 19th century and then rebuilt. And so even though the headquarters themselves were moved to this new location, there is still a temple on this site. And it's a wonderful place to visit should you ever be touring Japan. I visited there several years ago. And there's among the monks there, there was, I don't know if he's still there, but there was a German monk who was living there and practicing there. And he was English speaking. And so he was able to receive foreigners like myself and my husband who arrived to visit the temple. And he was extremely warm and welcoming. And so when I suppose he had a way of receiving people when they came, visitors, where he would first sort of show them around and then show them how to sit Zazen. And then we would sit Zazen and then go and have a meal, like a visitor's meal in the monastery, which was extremely nice food. I remember how interesting it was and how nice it was to receive this teaching from him and to learn the little details of which I really can't remember now what they were, but there were, you know, the little differences just in the way that the practice manifested there, or the way in which, you know, he taught me this introduction to Zazen. And when we finally got talking later in the day, and we exchanged experiences around ordination and practicing as an ordained person, one of the things that we shared was that we both found sewing practice very challenging and very slow going. And I said to him, "Oh, I've been trying to sew my okesa for a long time now, and it's really a challenge for me." And so he disappeared out of the room, and he came back like a few minutes later holding an okesa. And he said, I'd like you to have this. And I was really blown away. And he said, this is my ordination kesa. This is what I was given when I was ordained. He said, I have a different one now that I've sewn myself. So I don't need this anymore. So please take it so that you can wear it, since sewing one is so difficult for you. And I still wear it to this day. It doesn't quite fit me properly, but like literally every time I put it on, I think about what it meant to give something that in my mind is so, you know, such a seminal object, to just be able to give it away to somebody that you just met for the first time that day. Like, what would that be? It was an amazing teaching from this person. So the first line of the Zazen Yojinki reads, "Zazen means to clarify the mind ground and dwell comfortably in your actual nature. This is called revealing yourself and manifesting the original ground." Clarifying the mind ground and dwelling comfortably in your actual nature. This is Master Keizan's teaching. This is at the root of the teaching of the Zazen Yojinki. The text itself is maybe just a few pages long. It begins with a sort of a summary of the sort of ontological or metaphysical position of the Soto Zen approach. And then towards the end of the text, he goes into a more detailed instruction around sitting Zazen itself, you know, very specific about how to sit and where to sit. And then in the middle of the text, he offers some more general recommendations for a kind of lifestyle that nurtures practice. And contained within this section is a more prolonged teaching about the principles of renunciation. At one point in the text, he says, if you wish to clarify the mind ground, you should relinquish your various types of limited knowledge and understanding. Throw away both worldly affairs and Buddha Dharma. Eliminate all delusive emotions. When the true mind of the soul reality is manifest, the clouds of delusion will clear away and the moon of the mind will shine brightly. Now, I'm pretty sure that I know I've talked before quite a lot, maybe about the subjects of like relinquishment and renunciation. It occurs to me that it's a notion and a practice that's very much alive for me. One constant spiritual theme for me since childhood has been about the nature of loss and my relationship to loss, which for me is very much connected to the truth of impermanence and suffering. So this teaching from the Zazen Yojinki about letting go of mental, intellectual, worldly, emotional, even spiritual attachments is a deep teaching. These are the attachments that form the clouds of delusion. I think, as many of you know, my most recent lesson in the relinquishment of worldly affairs has manifested through the process of moving house. Wow. No one moving house ever says, gee, I had a lot less stuff than I thought I had. You know, oh, I bought 20 boxes and I only used 10. That doesn't happen. Anyone who's had that experience will be able to relate to that, I'm pretty sure. Anyone who spoke to me during those few weeks that I was moving will know that I had plenty to say about the hegemony of stuff, about the ways in which I really felt overwhelmed by the amount of stuff that was there. As I was clearing out my house, and especially the garage, which is kind of the purgatory of all not really needed objects in my house, I really was just overwhelmed by the sheer number of things that as a family, my family had amassed. And there was this kind of sense of horror around it. You know, how did this happen? How do we have so many things that we don't even use? And then I was present to like a sense of shame that came up around this, you know, the innate privilege of this situation of having too much. I tried to offer some of my more loved items that I couldn't take with me to friends, but for the most part, people, you know, very politely kind of just winced. Like I felt like I was offering like a fifth dessert at the end of a giant Thanksgiving dinner. Because, you know, I would just hear, well, I have enough already. Thank you. You know, we already have enough. We have no more space in our own kitchen. So I thought, you know, this is what it is to be cluttered. Clutter. I'd recently read some passages from a book by the poet and author May Sarton. She wrote this beautiful book called The Journal of Solitude, where she sort of shut herself away for a long period of time in order to really like reflect on what solitude meant to her. and what clearing out her life would really look like in that way. And she said, clutter is what silts up exactly like silt in a flowing stream when the current, the free flow of the mind, is held up by an obstruction. So I did eventually find ways to get items to people who needed them or who could at least use them. I also made use of the various social institutions that are set up to receive this influx of objects from people who have too much to the people who don't have enough. By taking care of each thing as it exited my home, I could acknowledge, or I tried to acknowledge, the attachment that I had to it. And at the same time, tried to be loving in the way that I sent it away. Because I realized that for myself, at least, attachment to objects in the world or in the realm of ideas or in emotions, it's a very natural thing. The other side of it is taking care of things, respecting the things that are around me, including in the physical world. The problem for me at least starts when I go into overdrive. When I accrue things, I get things out of some sense of dependence, or I'm thinking that certain objects might provide well-being, a sense of well-being for me, and then not wanting to let go of them through some kind of fear of depletion or lack. So in this sense, letting go can provoke anxiety. What if letting go of this thing, what if it puts me at a disadvantage? What if it makes me weaker? What if I become more vulnerable? And then I also realized, it's easy to build up a sense of shame or a kind of a sense of disgust, around these tendencies. And then the situation becomes very emotional and complicated. And it really doesn't need to be like this. In Buddhism, we talk about the five hindrances, the five obstructions. They are sensory desire, ill will, sloth, like a restlessness or worry, kind of anxiety, and doubt. And these obstructions or these hindrances are things that get in the way of practice and of tranquility, of entering into a state of ease, finding a state of ease. And I think that that these patterns of acquisition and letting go, they can be found nested within these principles or these hindrances, like the desire of gaining something through acquisition. This can be a tangible, even dizzy kind of buzz, a desire, through desire, and then the anxiety of letting go of things, the doubt that we can remain whole after an act of renunciation. So according to Buddhist teaching, these hindrances, they arise from a fundamental ignorance. And Master Keizan says in the Zazen Yojinki that even if all of these five hindrances, all of these things were all cut, even if you could cut desire, ill will, sloth, anxiety, doubt, if the fundamental ignorance that underlies them is not addressed, they'll just continue to keep coming up like weeds. They'll keep growing. And the ignorant mind is the clouded mind. It's the muddy mind. It's when the light of the moon is obscured by clouds. So that first line again, Zazen. Zazen means to clarify the mind ground and dwell comfortably in your actual nature. This is called revealing yourself and manifesting the original ground. And of course, the deeper sense of renunciation has to do with our inner process. Our outward letting go of objects in the world is a kind of practice for what is the real inner work of letting go. And that plays out in our compulsion to hold on to our opinions, our desires, our images and ideas about ourselves. So in thinking about working with that, I recently came across a really helpful notion in an article by the Buddhist teacher, Gil Fronsdal, who is he's a Theravada teacher, and he's also received Dharma transmission in Zen lineage. And it's an article that I found by him somewhere on the internet that was written recently. And in it, he brings forward this notion of letting go of something and then letting go into something. So he makes this point that renunciation in our culture and language has the connotation of giving something up, you know, of losing something. And then he refers to this sort of this Buddhist analogy for renunciation, which is slightly different. It has more this connotation of going out from a place that is confined and dusty into something that's wide open and clear, a big, wide open, clear space. He says, it's as if you've been in a one-room cabin with your relatives, snowed in for an entire winter. And while you may love your relatives, what is gained when you open the door and get out into the spring probably feels exquisite. So in this way, letting go can be an opening, you know, a kind of relaxation. I find it a very beautiful invitation to reframe the process of letting go, not as loss, but as entry into something different, something more open, more free, and without the constraints of attachment, like literally just letting go, like relaxing, opening. So in a moment of anxiety or doubt, then, you know, what would it be to let go of that tightness of worry and enter into a warmer, more welcoming space that's free of concern? And where there's fear of depletion, you know, where there's fear of scarcity, what would it be to give over and move deliberately into a more trusting space where there's plentitude, you know, where there's everything? To give something away, like that monk in Japan gave away his ordination kesa, to move graciously into that space of generosity. So recently I was asked to offer an introduction to Zen to somebody who was coming to Canada for the first time. And as I was showing this person around and we stepped into the Zendo, I was in that little like vestibule area where we have Suzuki Roshi's photo and the altar set up on one side, and then we have coat hooks and key hooks and little baskets to leave things on the other side. And in that moment, just that vestibule suddenly took on such a such a wonderful meaning for me. I thought, this is a place to leave things. You know, what a great way to start. What a great place to start in this practice of putting things down. And as I was sitting with the person on the Zafu, and they brought out their phone and they said, what should I do with this while I'm sitting? I guess I could just put it under the Zafuton, under the Zafuton. And I said, yeah, I suppose you could, you know, or you could leave it outside. You could leave it outside. And this is not, it occurred to me in that moment, you know, it's not about rule making, a hard and fast rule, like we must leave these things outside. You know, what can we and can't we bring into the Zendo? But it's an act of kindness, and it's especially in the way the world is today, you know, an invitation and an opportunity to put something down just for a short period. You can check it at the door, as they say, check that at the door. And it'll still be there if you need it. If you're worried about losing it, it'll still be there when you're done. So that's what I got tonight. So thank you. Thank you very much. And if you have any questions or comments, I would love to hear them.
Hello. Thank you so much, Vanessa. I just wanted to say that your talk is an inspiration. I have a garage full of items that I brought, our family brought with us from Seattle 10 years ago. It's absurd. And it's really, really helpful to be here and receive these teachings and their links to Keizan Zenji. And I'm feeling really hopeful about what might lead from this. So thank you so much.
Wonderful. I celebrate that sense of hope with you, Philip. Whatever the fate of those of the contents of your garage. Dave.
I can certainly sympathize with you and Philip about the contents of your garage. I don't think we have to compare who has the messiest garage, but I think mine's right up there. I was recently working with a friend of mine who is writing a paper about the history of a project that we both worked on at UC Berkeley decades ago. And on the one hand, he was very pleased that I found in the back of my garage a box with stuff that was useful to him in that project. But at the back of my mind, I was thinking, oh no, not another reason to hesitate to throw this kind of thing away. One of the things that really struck me, Vanessa, was in talking about you should go back to the original mind ground and relinquish limited knowledge. One of the things in the list there was Buddha Dharma. And that really struck me. And then as I was sort of trying to chew on that a little bit, it reminded me of the part of the Heart Sutra where it goes through this long list of items from Buddhist teachings about the five skandhas and the Four Noble Truths and all of that stuff. And sort of says, there's none of this, there's none of that, there's none of this, there's none of that. And the only sense I've ever been able to make out of that is that what you're supposed to do is let go of your intellectualized ideas of those things. And I'm guessing that in the same sense, the idea of relinquishing the Buddha Dharma on your path to practice is really letting go of your limited intellectualized ideas of it. Does that make sense?
Yeah, absolutely. I think it, especially in our Zen tradition and in the larger Buddhist tradition, with all the literature that's out there, it can get very thinky. You know, it can get that there's a danger. There's a way of engaging with a lot of that literature that can be very mentally satisfying, and then can sort of become the focus, you know, rather than the practice itself. And then also, I think, you know, one of the images that really struck me the deepest when I encountered it in practice was the image of putting down the raft once you've crossed the river. So there's an image that's offered in Buddhist practice, that in Zen practice, you know, that this practice itself is, it's a means. It's a skillful means. And what we're doing is crossing from one side to the other. But there's no need to, if you try and keep carrying that raft, once you've crossed the river, it's going to be very heavy. You're going to have a very sore back.
I think this is very similar to Suzuki Roshi used to refer to stepladders in, where when you come to an impediment, you come to a difficulty, that he said, I'm your friend with many stepladders, and I can give you the right stepladder to get over your difficulty. But once you get over the difficulty, don't walk on carrying the stepladders with you.
Yes, gosh. Yeah, that would, especially multiple stepladders, that feels so unwieldy. Yeah. Thank you, Dave. Peter.
Thank you, Vanessa. That was wonderful and very encouraging. And it reminded me of myself decades ago when I was in college. Strange to me that I can say that is decades ago now. And I remember I had been introduced to Zen, and I was starting to learn more about it. And I had two friends. And one of them, two friends who I admired very much, and one of them owned a small JanSport backpack and two changes of clothes and a pillow. And one day he decided that he would go and join a monastery. And it took one more action that morning for him to go. He had to grab his pillow in addition to his backpack. And that's the only thing that changed for him that day when he went off to join a monastery. I had another friend who, and I thought that was so amazing, and I admired it so much. And I had another friend who never allowed himself to own more than 10 things. Mm. And so when he got a bicycle, what did he let go of? He gave away his guitar. Mm. And one day he decided, I'm going to move to Europe. And so he gave away his bicycle and just got on a plane and went to Europe. And that I thought was so amazing. And for a very, very, very long time, I held this idea that letting go meant getting rid of, that letting go of things or possessions would mean that I didn't have those possessions anymore, that they weren't here, that like this clutter around me, like, oh, all this clutter around me, it means that I'm not being very Zen. It means I'm being a bad Buddhist. And it was such a freeing and lightening moment when I realized that, no, I can just stop seeing them as possessions and burdens. Instead, I have this, I'm at my desk and I'm surrounded by clutter. There's headphones and rubber bands and pens and papers with scribbles on them from 6 months ago. And my house is getting full of lots of new stuff, and I blur my background because it's all clutter back there. But these are all wonderful, beautiful little piles of things that I get to like be in their company as they move through the world. They came to me, I will help them on to wherever they go next. What a delightful little friend. Each little pile of clutter. It's not clutter, not possessions, not a burden, not something to push away. And so, yeah, what you were saying reminded me of that moment where I realized I can have no possessions if I simply don't see anything as a possession. And yeah, just wanted to share that.
I could see Philip's thumbs up. Thank you, Peter. That's really wonderful. That's a very, very warming perspective. It reminds me also of a time actually during that same trip in Japan when I then went to visit a teacher who has his own little temple, which is his house as well, you know, where he lives. And he lives alone, and he occasionally has students come to do seishin with him once a month. And as we were preparing to go and visit him and stay with him for a few days, I had all these like imaginings of, you know, what it would be like to go and stay with a Zen master in Japan. And I was imagining, you know, what the space would be like. And and then when we got there, there was so much clutter in this person's house. I mean, to the point where I thought, how does he even find things? Things were just piled in huge piles, and books and document objects everywhere, so much stuff. And it was so refreshing. It was such a great like realization for me as well. Such a great teaching of like, you know, about my expectations and you know, holding on to an idea that I need to be a certain way. Things need to be a certain way. And especially, I think, you know, I think relationship with objects around us can be a great koan. Thank you. Diane.
Thank you, Vanessa. So nice to see you. Your talk was beautiful. It in itself was like a beautiful introduction to Zen and our practice. It's so weird because I'm a purger. I'm always getting rid of stuff and throwing stuff away, and I have to have everything perfectly in order. And I have a daughter who is like me, only more extreme. And a son whose house is so cluttered. He's just a collector and a hoarder, and he's got stuff everywhere, and it's all disorganized. And I have trouble even going to his house. So I think some of us are purgers and some of us are hoarders. those are the two extremes. Anyway, and I think it has to do with our personalities. It has, and what do these objects or getting rid of objects mean? And it's whether we're attached to them and what meaning they have for us. I mean, it's so many different things, the things we surround ourselves with. And as Dave said, sometimes I've gotten rid of something and then, oh gosh, I needed that, or I could have given that to someone. And so things. The description of Peter and his friend with just a backpack and two changes of clothes, how freeing that would be. Anyway, going back to your talk where you said that there's a description of some ancestors and their enlightenments somewhere at the beginning of your talk. So I kind of have a question. Do you think that someone has an enlightening experience, like a sudden experience, or even over time has an experience of enlightenment and then that's it? Or do you think that it's a series of clarity and then muddiness and clarity and then muddiness and then understanding and then not understanding? And some of it could be intellectual, some of it could be emotional, some of it can be just what you feel in your bones. I don't know, I have more of a sense that it's not all one thing and then that's it. What do you think about that?
I appreciate hearing your sense of that, Diane. You know, it sounds like you have a very intuitive like feel for what that means. I think there are descriptions of both. Loud vehicles passing my window, sorry. You know, what's described as small satoris, great satoris. I think what you described is a common experience. And then there are accounts of these experiences of great satori as well, mm-hmm. of a much, I don't know, stronger or more impactful, like single moments somehow. Mm-hmm. And I think they're very, very personal. And I think it's very easy to kind of get tangled in, you know, thinking about what that might be and how can I make that happen? And, you know, what is all of that? So I think what you're bringing attention to here is a sort of a caution around that sort of mythology, which in itself can be a hindrance. Getting tangled in that can be a hindrance. You know, the idea that there is a book out there that tells us of these, you know, fireworks moments of enlightenment, this long lineage of practitioners from Buddha until, you know, these great masters. Yeah. It can be a little difficult to relate to also. And maybe in some ways what Keizan was trying to do by, you know, Keizan was sort of trying to popularize the practice, really, mm-hmm. you know, that was his intention. So in some ways, by sort of sitting down and writing it all in plain language, might have been, you know, his attempt to bring some of it home and to make people understand that actually these, you know, these masters were people who had practices. And then I'll let you read it if you're interested. You know, go ahead and see what you think of it. as a text.
Hmm.
But yes, I think, you know, I think it can be distracting, you know, to think that this practice might be the sort of a setup for some great life-changing experience.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas I think very much what Dogen and the master, you know, the teachers whose teachings we read and follow are pointing to, you know, the practice itself.
Mm-hmm.
It's itself. It's enough.
Right
now, this moment.
Yeah.
It's where we're at.
Yep. Mm. Thank you.
Thank you. David.
Well, I'd like to briefly offer a geezer's point of view.
Which point of view, David?
A geezer, a curmudgeon.
Oh.
Bumbling old fool man.
Please do, David.
I've moved many times, and I can't help but comment that the real torrent of acquisitiveness occurs when one brings a child into the family. The mountain of good and the complete compulsion to have this and that and this and that is just, it takes over your life, in my experience. So, about a year from now, I'm planning to move into a continuing care retirement community, the one being built with Zen Center up in Healdsburg. And they have a very agential, proactive, reaching out and helping people to get rid of stuff so they can downsize into the right size kind of place where I'm going to be living. I've moved several times. I've gotten rid of stuff each time, and I still have too much stuff. But the sobering thing about it is compared to all the adventures in midlife, you know, moving from Europe to the United States and Peter's moving around, it weighs on me greatly. This is going to be the last time I have to go through this cycle. So it is a cycle. When you're in midlife, it appears to go on forever and ever, and you're perhaps always tormented by too much or too little, and oh, I should have kept this and that. But I'm very aware that I am approaching the last move, and that's seems appropriate. Scary, but appropriate. Thank you.
Thank you, David. I wonder if you'd like to share a little more about the nature of that weight when you say it weighs on you. What is it that?
Well, the deeper thing is, of course, it's not just the final getting rid of stuff. Not everything, but most of the stuff. It's in fact, we had a cocktail. There are a number of us in this area that are planning to move to Enso Village. And we had a cocktail party. And we say, oh, we're going to get together at Enso Village and tell jokes and stories and tell all our lives. And then leave it to me to pipe up. Yeah, we'll have all those parties and then we'll die. Killjoy. So the finality of that, it's totally appropriate. It seems like a good healthcare option. And there's just an awareness of what I'm doing and what our neighbors are going to be doing, and it is going to be very difficult. One couple has resided in their home in Los Osos here for over 40 years.
Mm.
They're going to move into a 3-bedroom, 2-bath apartment. Wow. Mm. So it's that kind of weightiness, I think. Did that answer your question a bit?
Yeah.
Or
yeah,
sure. Coverage?
Yeah. Thank you, David. Thank you for sharing that. I hope your move goes well. I hope it's manageable in whatever way that it can be. Teresa.
Hi, Vanessa. How are you?
Thank you. I'm feeling what it is to be a morning person.
I'm putting on the robes so early. Well, there were so many things you said that kind of stayed in my mind. I also have stories, of course, of moving and giving away objects that I love very much. I remember when I moved from Washington to California, that I had a massive allergy reaction. I don't know if it was the dust or something. And when I moved from New York to Washington, D.C., the same. I had a big allergy reaction. So moving is traumatic for me. It was traumatic.
You're allergic to moving.
Yeah. And it must be because it's early in the morning, but I can't remember right now the name of the great patriarch, the story you told. What's his name? Sorry. The name of
Master Keizan.
Master Keizan, thank you. I'm not familiar with him, and I like what you said, that he was a supporter of female practitioners. That's nice. And giving away the Buddha Dharma, that made me think about, you know, how practice emphasizes so much direct experience. And that's, you know, it has such a different meaning, of course, when you have experienced it directly yourself, wherever it is. So for some reason, this random question came to my mind that I wanted to ask you. The story about the bad horse. Bad horse is the good horse. And why do you think is that? What is your reflection about that? The story about the horses, the horse that has to feel the pain most in his skin to kind of move. And how Suzuki Roshi said that the bad horse is the good horse, the one that is in a way the one that the horse that moves when the pain has really entered his body. I mean, I don't know if you're familiar with the story.
It's ringing a bell, but I'm not completely familiar. So I don't want to. I don't want to butcher it by unless you'd like to tell it. Would you like to tell it, Teresa?
I don't know if I remember it very well, but it's a story about, you know, there is a horse, you're riding a horse, and there is a horse that, you know, sees just the shade of the whip and just moves faster. And then the horse that, you know, really has to feel the pain inside to move, to go faster. And I'm not telling it very well. I should learn it better, but maybe I can find it here. We're getting close to the end. In any way, so I could ask it differently. I don't have to refer to this story about the bad horse, but why would it be that the person who has the most difficulty maybe in learning something? Why do you think that would be the best horse, so to?
I think what just came to mind for me was, you know, that phrase that we use, great doubt, great enlightenment. I think that having something to work with is motivating. If I'm in pain, I'm going to work to resolve that. And so there's an urgency, that the sense of urgency becomes clearer. The sense of urgency becomes clearer. If I have a short amount of time to resolve something, you know, if there's a deadline, you know, if something needs to be done very quickly and soon, then there'll be a kind of, at least for myself, there'll be a kind of clarity. You know, there's a way of just working through decisions, making decisions, and having challenges. Like pain is a good example, because it's not something that we rest in very easily. It's something that will motivate us to move. So that would be my feeling. Thank you for sending the story, Teresa. We'll take a look at it. It's in the chat. Anybody else wants to see it?
I cannot paste the text for some reason. Anyway, thank you, Vanessa.
Thank you, Teresa.
This talk was brought to you by the Canando Zen Meditation Center in Mountain View, California. For more information or to support this podcast, go to canando.org. That's K-A-N-N-O-N-D-O.org.